And two cases will be submitted on the briefs. The first case for argument is number 2008-1479, Vitamix v. Basic Holdings. Mr. Mobius, the appellant, you have taken 9 minutes for your opening argument and 6 minutes for rebuttal.
Correct.
Cross appeal and rebuttal, I guess, technically. You may proceed.
May it please the court. There's two primary issues that I want to address with respect to Vitamix's direct appeal. The first is the district court's erroneous construction of the claim term preventing the formation of an air pocket. And the second is the district court's erroneous summary judgment of no patent infringement and no trademark infringement. With respect to claim construction, the intrinsic evidence shows that the district court's importation of a limitation excluding all stirring was wrong as a matter of law. And with respect to the summary judgment issue, Vitamix came forward with significant evidence that establishes each disputed element of its claims. In contrast, Back to Basics failed to present evidence that, even if believed, would establish all elements of its claims.
Are we talking now about really the direct infringement allegation? I mean, even if we agree with you with respect to the change in claim construction that's required, it's not clear to me that, at least with respect to inducement and contributory infringement, why that would necessarily impact anything we do with respect to those allegations.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that really under either construction, there is inducement and contributory infringement. There certainly is Vitamix's evidence of
direct... My question is, if we were to agree with you with respect to the difference in claim construction, that in and of itself doesn't really impact the conclusion, at least the issue with respect to inducement and contributory. Am I right about that?
Well, I think that it would dispose of that issue, because the district court, for the most part, held that there was no inducement or no contributory infringement due to the absence of direct infringement. There were also issues regarding intent that can address, but the primary thrust of the district court's opinion was the absence of direct infringement due to the stirring issue resulted in a finding of no direct infringement or inducement or contributory infringement.
But even if we were to find direct, it's quite possible, is it not, to affirm on inducement and contributory infringement for other reasons?
It would be possible for other reasons, yes, but the evidence that Vitamix presented with respect to both, we believe, on intent and with respect to the existence of significant non-infringing uses, warrants reversal on those issues as well.
But you're saying basically that the indirect infringement would depend upon the direct infringement itself, right?
Yes, you must show direct infringement.
And you're also challenging the fact that the district court changed the definitions as we as she started going through the process?
Yes, and the key issue with respect to the change of the claim construction is that the construction that the district court used was wrong as a matter of law, that there's no support in the intrinsic record for an exclusion or a limitation excluding all stirring. That error permeates the entire summary judgment ruling with respect to infringement, both direct and indirect infringement. And then with respect to the indirect infringement issues, for inducement, Vitamix presented evidence that I think it establishes the specific intent to cause the direct infringement for inducement, in that Back to Basics clearly knew about Vitamix's patent before it sold a single unit of the accused products. And it did not, despite that knowledge, did not seek an opinion of counsel. And then it produced products and sold products where the physical configuration of those products meets every one of the structural limitations of Claim 1 of Vitamix's patent. As a result, when those products are used, they will infringe by default. You turn the blender on with the device inside and it will infringe. The only way to avoid infringement in that situation is if a user will specifically and intentionally manipulate the device in a way to avoid infringement.
But this default, this is for a second, right? I mean, the instructions, at least some of the customers, reflect a non-infringing use. So what you're left with is some short period of time.
I think the instructions, none of the instructions, we believe, teaches a non-infringing use. And at a minimum, there's a genuine issue of fact.
Does the instruction say that the user should stir with the stir stick while scraping the sides of the container? Aren't those the instructions?
There are some instructions that Back to Basics began using more than a year into this case, and after they had sold more than 10 million infringing units.
Let me make sure I understand, because this is an important point for me as well. There were the original instructions, and then the November 2007, is that the right date? The second set of instructions where the scrape the edge material came in. Now, your contention is that, quite apart from the 2007 instructions, that there's inducement with respect to the original instructions, which were silent on the scraping of the edge and the stirring. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is our position.
But you think there's inducement as to both, but you say surely as to the first set.
That is correct.
Okay.
And for a number of the instructions, Back to Basics never disputed that the instructions were silent with respect to any manipulation of the device that would lead to non-infringement. For others, there is a question of fact as to whether or not those instructions will lead to a non-infringing use. But then Vitamix also presented a consumer survey that showed that when customers use the device or use the accused products for the first time, vast majority of them will use it in a non-infringing manner.
And the district court didn't let that in, right?
The district court did not let that in, saying it was not relevant. But then later in the district court's opinion, the district court relied on the survey as relevant. And in fact, on appeal now, Back to Basics has not tried to even support the district court's exclusion, and instead has conceded that it is relevant on at least some issues. So, with respect to contributory infringement, the only issue with respect to contributory infringement is whether or not there are substantial non-infringing uses for the accused products. And Back to Basics has identified two alleged substantial non-infringing uses. The first I want to talk about is they say they don't use the device at all. That would be a substantial non-infringing use. But not using the device can't be a substantial non-infringing use for the device.
Well, I think they say you just don't
manipulate it.
I mean, there's a question of what happens in the default setting, right?
But I think their point is you can run the blender without using the device.
When you say
the
device
sitting on the table.
You mean using the plunger.
Right.
Not putting the plunger in the device at all.
Correct.
As opposed to manipulating the plunger or not manipulating the plunger.
Correct. I think they argue if you stir.
But if they don't use that, why is there infringement?
Well, I think the question is that a substantial non-infringing use for the device itself? Because the contributory infringement is the sale of a component part that here it's specifically configured to infringe. All of these non-infringing uses could have been can also be performed with a plunger that's configured as the prior art that would only be used to break up an air pocket after it's formed.
But even after you do not, if you do not hold a stirring mix stick, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it move because of the movement of the blender itself?
No.
It's going to move, isn't it? I mean, it's not going to be standing firm above the pocket.
In fact, it will. Vitamix presents significant evidence, including its expert's opinion, that due to the physics of how the fluids move in the blender, what it essentially creates is a vacuum that will draw the stir stick and maintain it both adjacent to and above the blades, and free of contact with the sides of the pitcher, which are the two limitations that must be met for the method. With the prior, and that specifically occurs because the device or the plunger is configured so that its cross-sectional size approximates the cross-sectional size of the member associated with the blades. If the device was not configured to have that size that approximates, then yes, it most likely would move. But because it's properly sized, it's drawn into the center of the mixing fluids and maintained in exactly the infringing position unless somebody grasps the top of it and moves it in a manner where it would either not be adjacent to and above the blades or where it would be in contact with the sides of the pitcher.
But there are all these design features that include the O-ring and the ribbing. All of those are designed to promote a non-infringing use, are they not?
Well, that's their argument. But with respect to direct intent, their intent in designing the machine is, or direct infringement, their intent in design is not relevant. And
am I right? I mean, did I get a yes or a no on this yet?
I don't think that those are relevant issues. They claim that they are relevant, but I don't believe that they are.
So you agree with the fact that certain many of the designs of the accused are designed to promote other uses, non-infringing uses. You just think, you agree with that, and you just don't think that's relevant?
I don't think that they're designed to promote. I think they're designed to, if somebody uses it in a non-infringing way, for example, the O-ring will prevent marring on the side of the pitcher, but they don't promote this non-infringing use because they never teach the non-infringing use. The instructions are silent on the non-infringing use.
Wait, all the instructions, all the advertisements, they don't go to the non-infringing use? Just the stirring?
No, I believe that they're the instructions that they distribute with the product teach people to insert the device within the pitcher and operate the blender. They don't teach stirring. Some of them teach rotation of the device, but none of them until, you, like you pointed out, in November 2007, after they sold 10 million units, mentioned anything about stirring whatsoever. And so the fact that the machine is capable of a non-infringing use does not mean that there is not direct infringement. The question is whether or not that direct infringement occurred. And under this court's established case law, the sale of a machine that's capable of infringing use, accompanied by instructions teaching that infringing use, constitutes evidence of infringement that's sufficient, certainly, to survive summary judgment.
On the O-rings, were the O-rings on the machine prior to November 2007?
There are some machines that had O-rings, and there are some machines that they sell without O-rings.
Okay. You're into your reply and yes. Cross-appeal time. Do you want to save it?
I'll save it. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Larry Laycock of the Workman Nidegger firm, appearing on behalf of Basic Holdings. The facts and governing law in this case combined to demonstrate that the claim construction as decided by the District Court was absolutely correct as a matter of law. In addition, the findings of non-infringement must stand based on the complete lack of evidence and likewise survive this challenge because they were appropriate as a matter of law. First,
Let me see if I understand something just before we get going into the claim construction, because I found this to be a somewhat unusual claim link. If I am using the device, let's say, and I turn it on, and it, let's assume, I'm not sure you accept this, but let's assume for purpose of argument that the device, that the plunger stays in what Vitamix calls the default position in the middle for a period of time while I put in stuff and then I go over and putter around the kitchen for a few seconds. And then I come over and I stir for a while and then I stop stirring and I go putter around for a while. Are those two instances of infringement with a period of non-infringement in the middle, or is it all non-infringement because I stirred, I gave it two or three spins around the edge?
Well, the District Court was correct when it described the process that's urged as an infringement position, this sort of a few seconds of infringement and then not infringement, as a Frankenstein method of approaching the infringement
question. Well, but let's take it the other way around. Many seconds of the plunger sitting there while the machine is running and a few seconds of scraping the edge with the plunger.
We only need to turn to Vitamix itself and the intrinsic record here to determine that it was at all times. You'll recall that they added claim 9. What they said was that at all times the stir stick must be kept or prevented from touching the sides or moving to the side.
It can't be that broad, because that would mean if you, at some point in the course of the first year that you own the thing, you scrape the edge, then you don't ever infringe.
It's each use of the product.
So if I'm using the product for half an hour, sure, as long as I stir once, in minute 29, no infringement for the entire half hour. That's your position?
That would be correct for a couple of reasons. First, they disclaimed. It was Vitamix that clearly disclaimed and disavowed a stirring operation. They distinguish, in fact, at 1018 of the appendix, they say that because the method is completely distinguishable from a stirring operation. Now, this goes to a couple of temporal terms.
But the problem with that is, it's one thing to say that stirring is not within the scope of our claim, which is to say that you don't infringe when you stir. It's another thing to say, if you ever stir during the operation of the machine, then there is no infringement even when you're not stirring.
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is, and they're between the rock and the hard place on this. If they say that this default position actually constitutes an infringement, what they're really saying is that all of the prior art, and you find an accused product that just has a tamper that is placed within a blender, that's infringement. If you just leave it in what they call, and there is no such thing as a default position, because the evidence in this record says that and demonstrates, both video evidence as well as other evidence, testimonial, demonstrates that moves around, just as we have noted previously in this argument. So there is really no default position, but assume there is. And if that's the situation,
we back right into an
invalidity problem, because you've got Jacobson, Wayne, Harris, and that's exactly why, at page 1018 of this record, they narrowed this claim down as far as they did, and that's why the judge was correct in making this claim construction. Because without that, they fall squarely into all of these other products that have a tamper and just let it come down. And in the case of Jacobson, they acknowledge in the course of the prosecution that particular piece of prior art had the appropriate cross-sectional value. It's right in the right place. And the examiner said, you've got an invalidity problem. That's when they came in at 1018 and they said, no, we distinguish completely the stirring process, because if you stir at all, you're going to create this situation, actually enhance the ability to create air pockets. And that makes it impossible to prevent air pockets. If you look at 1016 and 1017...
Enhance the creation of...
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I draw your attention, Your Honor. If you go to 1016 of the record with me, at 1016 of the record, it says, the cited prior art relates only to stirrers, which at best can only dislodge the air pocket once formed. Continuing on, if you go to the bottom of page 1016 of the record, they say, in response, in fact, it would be undesirable to move the plunger because then the air pocket could be allowed to form.
Well, that's just to say that if the plunger is not moved, the air pocket never forms. Not that stirring actually causes
air
pockets.
In other words,
the air pocket would... Well, go ahead.
Let's go on to 1017.
Okay, that's fine.
Middle of the page. This distinguishes stirrers in that after the formation of the prior air pocket, they must be moved to dislodge the same. So this brings us to the prevention issue, Your Honor. Remember, they say in their claim you have to prevent the formation under all circumstances. An analogous situation would be, you know, if you've got a forest fire and it's burning the forest down and you finally put it out, you haven't prevented a forest fire. If you get an air pocket at any time, let's say you stir, in your scenario, you stir and you've got an air pocket, okay, because that would allow it to form, even according to Vitamix. Under that situation, you've not prevented, in that blending process, an air pocket. And they chose the words. Vitamix chose the words to prevent, at all times, the formation. That's what this claim requires. And so the judge was correct in the claim construction.
That's how they distinguish from prior art, though.
I'm sorry.
That's how they distinguished themselves from prior art.
It is precisely how they distinguished themselves
from prior art. And they had to avoid that in order to anticipate the prior art.
But precisely, sir.
The question that Judge Bryson asked, if in fact there is an infringing use for 1 minute, is that sufficient?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that it would infringe. Yeah, if there is a complete infringement for 1 minute, that would be, it would require that fluid be added as according
now,
to the
does,
method.
Does that matter whether or not you have 29 minutes of non-infringement?
If you have formation of an air pocket during that 29 minutes, in other words, if you want to pick and choose just that minute and say this is infringement, in that minute you would have to perform all the steps of the method. That is, you would have to add the fluid, you would have to prevent the formation of the air bubble, you would have to maintain the plunger, or the, in our case, we call it a stir stick, for the reason that it is a stir stick. And you'd have to have all of those events take place in the course of those seconds.
Right.
And if you don't have that situation, and that was never shown, there's no evidence, even, for example, in the 26-second period that they point to in the Tom Daniels experience as part of the evidence and the references that they make here today, in each of those, they don't have
all of, in this scenario, you don't have all of the steps performed.
But let me see if I understand your answer to Judge Gallardo. You are saying, I think, that if they start out in the kitchen, you pour the fluid in, mm-hmm. you turn it on with the plunger in, and you walk away and stand back for 26 seconds, and then you start stirring, you have 26 seconds of infringement, including the time taken to pour the fluid in.
What you have under those circumstances, first, Your Honor, is
an invalid
claim.
Let me make sure that your answer, I understand you're running to validity, but to get your answer to Judge Gallardo clear in my mind, you're saying that would be a period of infringement, correct?
I do not concede that, Your Honor, because during that period of time, okay. again, they would have to show that you prevented. There's no evidence that there's any, and this is the record that the court had to deal with. There's no evidence that a situation occurred where all of the events necessary, and think of this claim, you have very specific apparatus-related claim elements, you have very specific steps, and they have temporal limitations. You have to maintain and prevent over the entire period of time, and the court was clear when it said, during the time the blades are running. Because we urged the claim construction that said during the entire
period of time. But the blades are running for that 26 seconds. Are you saying that that because of the enablement problem that Dr. Rashidi referred to, that there's never prevention, this just doesn't work, and therefore no air pocket is prevented, then therefore there's no infringement?
That's
that
part
the
of the argument, but it's also this, Your Honor, we urged in the claim construction that the entire process be considered. In other words, don't split this into little, 26-second segments. The court said, well, we don't need to do that because the claim, at the end of the claim, says very clearly that while the blades are running. That's the process we're talking about. So when the blades start up, that's the process.
As long as you stir at some point before you turn the blades off, you don't infringe, even if you've had the machine operating in its prescribed manner for 5 minutes.
And the court properly construed it that way, Your Honor, because
of the invalidity
problem.
That's a different answer, I think, from the one you gave Judge Gallardo.
What I was saying, my answer to Judge Gallardo was this. If you have all of the elements present in that 26-second segment, that is, you pour in the liquid, you have a plunger, it does everything that's required, but that never happens.
But for those 26 seconds is infringement.
It's a hypothetical situation. It's never been proven in this case. There's no evidence that ever occurred.
Well, see, the problem I think you have is that we did this on summary judgment, and we did it on summary judgment with the district court judge excluding Vitamix's survey evidence and its expert. And it seems to me that makes it a much closer question. We are not here deciding ultimately the question of infringement, but only whether or not summary judgment was appropriate.
Well, and that takes us, Your Honor, to the question that you asked before about, what do we really prove in terms of infringement? There is no evidence, even under the scenarios. Even if you assume and take all of the evidence offered by the survey, which was considered in part, it still doesn't reach the level of proof of all of the elements being present here. There is no direct infringement for the reason that there is, under the appropriate claim construction, no showing of all of the elements as a matter of law. They've not met their burden. Beyond that, if you turn to the indirect, there still is no proof in terms of intent. You have the design features, as the court noted. In the design features, it is designed to stir. They even call it, in every instruction manual, 2007 November and before, it's referred to as a stir stick. Move the stir stick, turn the stir stick. The ergonomics of that are made so that it actually, in this ball and socket configuration,
as the other side pointed out, you changed the instructions to more explicit.
Sure, there was a mediation, and really under rules of evidence, that shouldn't be considered. But the fact is, we did in November just further clarify. But every set of instructions had both non-infringing alternatives, where you just use a cap, a lid on the top of the blender. Use it as a blender. Remember, they didn't accuse stir sticks. They accused blenders. And if you put a blender with the lid on it, that is a substantial non-infringing use. And they admit that. There is a candid admission by everyone that matters on the Vitamix side of the case that constitutes a substantial non-infringement, and they say that it exists. They admit it. There goes contributory infringement. On inducement, again, there's no intent. They have to show specific intent, and here we have a situation in which you have every effort is to demonstrate stirring. The packaging shows stirring with the stick contacting the inner surface of the pitcher. You have every instruction. You have arrows in the instructions that show the turning
and the actual stirring mechanism. You have every video clip showing where it's demonstrated there's a stirring mechanism. All the instructions talk about turning that stir stick. We call it a stir stick. There can be no specific intent under this particular...
Well, what if you called it a plunger? Would that make any difference?
I think
it still has the same function.
It has the same function. However, by calling it a stir stick, Your Honor, we're drawing attention to what was disavowed and disclaimed completely. Now, if you interrupt or disrupt that infringement determination, really what you've done is you've pushed this claim back into an invalidity position because you have all, even the as the examiner noted, even the products of Vitamix would cause invalidity to occur under its 3600 product, its 4000 Vitamix product. In all of these scenarios, there cannot be an infringement. Now, I know time is about to expire.
Did the court interpret the claim in order to avoid invalidity?
Yeah, of course. It was bumping up against the prosecution history in all events. The court very clearly found as part of its claim construction that it was Vitamix who completely distinguished and unambiguously, as you note the court's language, distinguished its claim from a stirring operation. Consistent with what exactly was said by Vitamix at page 1018 of the record. Now recall, and I think you found this to be a surprise, but if you go through and scrutinize pages 1016 through 1018 of the record, you will see that they call out stirring as something that will actually cause or enhance this idea of the formation of an air pocket.
Yeah, I read...
Now, finally, Your Honors...
Can I ask a quick question, a process question on your
cross
appeal? It's a conditional cross appeal, correct?
It is.
So if we were to affirm on the summary judgment of no infringement, then the cross appeal goes away.
Correct.
What if we were to reverse on direct infringement but affirm on inducement and contributory? Does that make the cross appeal go away?
No, it would not, for the reason that if you address, for two or three reasons. The first reason is that by doing that, you've got to step away from the present claim construction, and to do so would cause, I see that my time has expired.
Well, go ahead, we'll give you a little
extra
time
to respond.
Of course.
So what you have is a situation where this occurs. If you were to send back just the direct infringement question, that would implicate claim construction. That would require, of course, the remand of anticipation and obviousness. We say obviousness should go back under any circumstance for the reason that the court simply made a mistake.
We said under any circumstances. This is all subject to the conditional.
It's subject to the conditional, yes.
Understood.
Now, let me further clarify on that because you recall the court's basis for decision was that on the obviousness question, she said we basic holding did not rely on an expert witness testimony. Now, that's crucial for the reason that there were two motions, one brought by basic holding, another brought by Vitamix, in opposition to the motion, which is the subject of appeal here on obviousness. There was clear reliance. In fact, we had 67 pages of
no, your
reliance.
Position is there was just a mess up. It was an oversight given that this court judge had 15 motions for summary judgment.
Yeah, so if you send back the question on direct infringement, you've got to send back that obviousness question as well. But it would also implicate enablement. It would implicate anticipation. Now, it would also implicate the issues where you have some usurpation of the credibility finding as a factual matter on the inequitable conduct, and it would also implicate the usurpation of that factual finding.
I guess I was getting for a more practical answer, because if it was a conditional cross appeal and the potential damages were affected by the absence of any inducement or contributory infringement claim,
yes.
Whether as a practical matter it would go away.
And as a practical matter, yes, going right to that question, Your Honor, it should go away because if what Vitamix does is prove a couple of instances of direct infringement and there is no induced infringement, which there can't be because of the lack of specific intent, and there cannot be contributory infringement because of the existence of substantial non-infringing alternatives. Under those circumstances, there isn't a damage base at all. You have a couple of instances at best, and because of the lack of damage, really what you end up with is an invalid patent, either anticipated or obvious or non-enabled, and the case would go away under any circumstance as a practical matter.
At the risk of making you work overtime here, let me ask you one further question. You mentioned the absence of specific intent. Give me, in a nutshell, the core of your argument with respect to the absence of specific intent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Specific intent under the DSU medical case, as this court is aware, requires an act, a specific intent, an action to induce infringement that must be proven. If we look at the semantic test for specific, that's 522 Federal 3rd at a pin site 1292, what the court found there was that that specific intent that's spoken of is necessary to prove induced infringement. The inducer must have an affirmative intent to cause direct infringement. Now, that specific intent is absent for a number of reasons. Let me list them.
All right.
Number one, as noted, the design of the product itself shows an avoidance of what was clearly disavowed. In other words, the design of the product shows and incorporates a ball and socket mechanism that facilitates and encourages, and you even saw in the video clips, when the machine is left running in the Judge Gazarza scenario, it tends to turn, and it will even contact the inner surface of the mechanism. Now, on the inner surface of the pitcher, you have rib cutouts. The pitcher has ribs that run on the inner surface of the goblet. Those are interrupted at a position precisely at a point that to allow this ball and socket stir stick to contact the inner surface of the device. Then you have on the distal end of that stir stick, you have an O-ring.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you have the shape of the handle is in a bulb that allows or facilitates ergonomically this motion. Now, two, the second important reason is, so we have design, we have the complete lack of a showing of the specific intent, not just intent, it's specific intent. There's never been any evidence that Basic Holdings acted to cause others to engage, affirmatively engage in infringement.
What's the state of the knowledge of the patent evidence? Knowledge of the existence of the patent?
I think there was general awareness because of other applications that were being filed, but this was viewed essentially as something completely different because it disavowed stirring.
All right.
So you go to the instructions. Now, the instructions always mention at any time, and this is pre-November 2007, that the fact that it's actually a stir stick. That states the intent. This is a stick that's provided to stir. You're taught, and this is at the record, A2776 and 2785, to turn, rotate, and move the stir stick. The pictures that accompany the stirring motion with arrows and show that the stirring should occur in a manner that causes this contact with the inner surface. That you can find at 2834 and 2832. In fact, there's even a card that was inserted down into, and you'll see this, it's kind of a splayed view of the blender, and that's because it was folded and placed actually inside the blender. You'll see these instructions. Among others that have incorporated these arrows, these were in the briefs. The packaging demonstrated that the stir stick contacted the inner surface of the picture. It was actually shown.
This is the little mark that shows up. That's the O-ring hitting the surface.
Precisely so. Okay. So the packaging demonstrates. I know we've gone over, but it instructs the user to use the stir stick to break up air pockets intended to be formed by the shape of the picture. In other words, the idea of the stir stick and the configuration. This is found at A413, 2678.
This is in the November 2007 instruction.
This is before
the breakup pockets.
Just talking about instructing to use the. You're told to use the stir stick to break up air pockets that have already formed. The idea is you throw the materials back into this vortex or air pocket, and it helps break things up. Remember, dislodge, disperse, break up. Finally, if you look, examine the video information here. In each case, the clips will show either contacts of the stirring stick, surfacing of bubbles showing the presence of an air pocket. They also show that there is no default position. If you let the stir stick go, it continues to rotate and turn, just as mentioned by Your Honor. And the trailer server finally fails to demonstrate any indirect infringement. What it does is it was manipulated. They wanted to call, they chose a new name, even though they wanted to call, the people that were doing the survey wanted to say, let the stir stick turn, continue to turn. They changed that to default position. That was an attorney construct. And at best, the data was manipulated to try and show their position, but it really showed that You have this turn.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Laycock. Mr. Movius, we're going to give you some extra time, Mr. Movius. We've given Mr. Laycock an extra little over 7 minutes, so we'll give you some extra time if you need it.
Thank you.
You're not required to use it.
I'll do my best not to use it. I do have a few points I'd like to hit here. With respect to back-to-basics arguments, the most, I think, striking feature of their arguments today is, aside from the claim construction, every argument was directed towards weighing and balancing the evidence, what Vitamix showed and what back-to-basics showed, and why they disagree with what Vitamix showed, why the district court disagreed with what Vitamix showed based on back-to-basics evidence. If we are here after a jury trial, that would be an appropriate conversation. But today we're here on summary judgment, where the only question on infringement is whether Vitamix came forward with evidence that, if believed, and with the benefit of all reasonable inferences, would be sufficient to establish the disputed elements of its claims.
We understand the parameters of the argument. I think it would be very helpful, at least to me, if you could get right down to the nitty-gritty and address, for example, the points that Mr. Laycock just laid out with respect to inducement.
Certainly.
And with an eye towards where there are conflicts in the evidence that was presented to the district judge.
With respect to inducement and the intent issue, the DSU medical case is clear that the specific intent to cause direct infringement exists where the accused infringer knew or should have known that their actions would result in direct infringement. The case law also teaches that such knowledge of a result exists where there is the knowledge of the patent that's being asserted for infringement, and then where there are sales of products that are capable of infringing use. That's exactly what we have here. So if you follow the case law exactly under DSU and its progeny, that's where we end up. With respect to each of the, calling something a stir stick, or what the instructions teach, whether they're before 2007, after 2007, the record shows conflicting evidence at best on this. Both sides proffered experts on this issue. What the district court did was it just picked which one it liked better and went with it. But where there's conflicting expert testimony, where there's conflicting fact evidence, what instructions teach what, summary judgment simply isn't appropriate. Intent is an inherently fact-based inquiry, and Vitamix came forward with the evidence that shows Back to Basics knew of the patent. It designed a product where, although it may have other features as well, it is specifically configured so that it will practice this patented method. There's no dispute in the record that the accused products are capable of infringing use.
But even with intent, though, isn't it a fact that we need to show direct infringement?
Correct.
That there is an actual direct infringement. If, under the claim language as interpreted by the lower court, there cannot be any direct infringement, since the invention that is patented under the claim is the absence of the formation of the bubble. You're trying to avoid the formation, but they're doing it after the formation, so they're correcting it after the formation of the bubble. So if you take it on that basis, that the claim as interpreted by the lower court is correct, can there be direct infringement, indirect infringement?
Under either construction, whether it's the district court's Markman construction or the construction it used to grant summary judgment, there is direct infringement for purposes of inducement and contributory infringement.
Well, there's only one interpretation, one construction.
Right. But if you were to stay with the district court's construction or to reverse it under either, there would be direct infringement. And that's because that's under the line of cases, the Moleculon case, the Golden Blount case, the Rico v. most recently Rico v. Quanta. Those cases are clear that where there's sales of in products that are capable of infringing use, accompanied by instructions that teach infringement, that is circumstantial evidence that every one of the accused products will be used to directly infringe. And that's, Mr. Laycock refers to a Frankenstein's monster. The district court never found
even
that.
Even as we talked before, if there's 29 minutes of non-infringement and 1 minute of infringement,
to
it could be used to that point of 29 minutes of non-infringement?
In that situation, the fact of some stirring for the 20, if there's a period of no stirring and then a period of stirring, there's infringement there because there's no temporal limitation on the claim. There's no requirement that the claim be performed for the entire time that the blades are running, so long as the steps are followed. The instructions teach this, to put the plunger in, add pot to the blender, put the plunger in, operate the machine. And so long as that stir stick stays adjacent to and above the blades and free of contact, there's infringement. If something occurs after the fact, time plus 20 seconds in, the user does something, that doesn't change the fact of what happened before there's the manipulation there. Back to Basics had asked for such a limitation during claim construction, and the court disagreed and said, not only does the claim not require that, but nothing in the remaining intrinsic evidence would require such a temporal limitation. So, on that direct point, yes, there would be infringement for that initial period. It's important, I think, on this too, with respect to the construction issue, that the claim doesn't, there's this discussion about stirring, but stirring never appears in the claim itself. And what we're really talking about here is movement of the stir stick. And not all movement is precluded. The claim itself speaks directly to this point. It says there are two things that must occur. The plunger must remain adjacent to and above the blades. So that tells you where in the picture vertically the device or the plunger must be. And it says it must be maintained free of contact with the sides of the pitcher. So now we're talking about horizontally within that area where the device must be. Those are the two limitations that are important here that talk specifically about what you can and can't do with the plunger. The specification discusses stirring. When you go to the prosecution history, Back to Basics' own Markman brief arguments show that not all stirring was disclaimed. What they argued there was that the four statements that are at issue now before the court only talked about stirring to disperse, dislodge, or break up an air pocket after it had already begun to form, which the inventors never tried to claim. There's no dispute that that's outside the scope of the claim here, because the claim calls for preventing the formation of the air pocket. The prior art is what disclosed using it after the air pocket forms to stir and break it up.
Before your time runs out, can
sure.
I direct you to the cross appeal and
yes.
to the questions of validity? You do not dispute, do you, that the refusal to allow certain of the evidence, with I think it's mainly at least parts of Dr. Rashidi's testimony, was an error? The district court was an error in excluding portions of that testimony.
The district court didn't exclude any part of Dr. Rashidi's testimony. The problem there, and this is why a change in claim construction does not require a reversal with respect to invalidity and inequitable conduct, is the problem, or what the district court ruled correctly, is that Back to Basics did not present Dr. Rashidi's evidence. They never cited once to his opinion regarding anticipation. And his opinion of the in his report was there needs to be a combination of five references to render the claim obvious. They argued four in summary judgment, and then now to this court, for the first time, they've raised a three reference combination. That's not in the record anywhere below. That argument was waived. And then, in fact, in their reply brief, they raise a new argument now for the first time.
But what are the three? You've got Wayne and Jacobson.
And divided 3,600, 4,000.
Oh. And so, is the 4,000 prior art as well as the 3,600? That was a little unclear to me. Are they basically the same?
They're the same thing. It was a page referring to those two products that was submitted into the prior art.
Difference in wattage? Is that what the difference is? 40 watts as opposed to 36?
Something like that. They're functionally the same.
That's what the 5,000 is all about, right? It's the 50
watts.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. The 5,000 was a trademark issue, which...
It's not 5,000 watts, is it?
No, it's not 5,000 watts, but it is, I think, 2 horsepower, so it's quite powerful. None of that prior art actually discloses the element of approximating the cross-sectional size. Back to Basics' argument in their brief on this issue was it would be, I think, painfully apparent to anyone looking at the figures. Well, that's not the standard for invalidity. It actually has to disclose the approximating the cross-sectional size to meet the all-elements rule for there to be invalidity, which it does not. So because Back to Basics did not present evidence that under any construction could establish invalidity, a change in claims construction does not affect that, and the district court should be affirmed on that.
Let me just ask you a nitty-gritty question. If we assume in Jacobson that the rod is approximately the same diameter as the hub of the propeller, does Jacobson anticipate?
Jacobson is not known, because Jacobson first does not disclose does not disclose prevention of the formation of an
error. But your argument is that if the structure, I think you made it today earlier, if the structure of the device is according to the claim, then necessarily there will be prevention of the formation of an air pocket.
Well, there's no teaching in Jacobson.
That is your argument, right?
That is our argument,
right.
Yes.
So if Jacobson is the same structure, then it necessarily, according to you, prevents the formation of an air pocket, right?
If Jacobson were the same structure,
right, it would necessarily prevent the formation of an air pocket.
But there's no teaching in the record that it is the same structure.
Okay, now what about Jacobson is not the same? If you assume, let me assume for the moment that the plunger and the hub are the same diameter. What else is different about Jacobson?
I'm not sure it does not teach the key element of the claim is the approximating the cross-sectional size.
Okay, so you,
the fact is there, that was the way Jacobson shows
it. That's really where that is the crux of the distinction of Jacobson for purposes of invalidity.
Yeah, so what Jacobson also teaches is that you rotate it with, there's a little boot on the end of Jacobson that is used in specifically for breaking up already formed air pockets.
But if you don't turn the little boot, if you just leave it there, sitting there in one spot, then it performs the patented method if the hub and the rod are approximately the same diameter, right?
I guess I don't feel competent to answer that because Jacobson is a line drawing, and it's in a hypothetical situation here where it's impossible. You know, I'm not sure there is even a commercial embodiment of Jacobson where that could be verified as to what it is. There's no, and I guess maybe to answer your question more directly is, there's no evidence in the record on that point. There's nothing that I can cite to or that anybody else can cite to that would show that that would occur.
Technically, Mr. Laycock, you have the right for a rebuttal, since we have talked a little bit about invalidity. If you want to take 30 seconds, if there's something that you're just you must advise the court, you may go ahead and speak briefly.
There was an incorrect statement of law with respect to specific intent. It's not enough to just know or should know. You have to actually have the affirmative intent to cause.
Okay, that's actually, I think, not on the cross appeal issue, so that's out of bounds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just conclude and ask this court to affirm the non-infringement conclusions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We thank both counsel. The case is submitted.